Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting here with Sarah McDooling, and we're across from, weirdly, strangely, and wonderfully,
excitingly,
Eric Idle. Eric Idle, thank you very much for coming and talking to us.
You're very welcome. I'm a book freak, so I'm very happy to be here.
We might just skip over the whole the fan thing, because as you point out in your book, fan comes from fanatic.
And we would like you to talk in the podcast. If we talk about what fans we are, it'll take up the whole 20 minutes.
Yeah, we've been reading your sort of biography, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, and chuckling along with you, but also learning quite a lot about you and your past and all the associations and the people you've met over the time. It is an extraordinary life.
Well, it's been a long life. if in comedy, it's a nice life in comedy, because when people see you, unlike rock and roll, they don't try and kill you on the whole, you know. If you're going through an airport and somebody recognizes you, they smile.
Yeah.
Because they're probably remembering you in some terrible costume up to your neck in mud or blood or something. So they're always very nice to you as a comedian. They're grateful usually.
But and you talk about the generation that you were a part of, and you seem to suggest that, the time that you were born, a crazy time for people to be having children in the middle of a war, but the time which you're born within the Second World War, it's kind of etched out a generation of artists within the UK and the US that you kind of grew up with and learnt with.
Particularly in the UK, because the US didn't have the devastation. The war wasn't in there. It was abroad always for the USA. But for England, it was completely devastated at the end of 6 years of war. And we were born, I was in 1943, most of us were born in that period, towards the end of the war. And when it finished, there was just nothing. There was shortages. There was rationing. There was rationing until we were about 12. So if you wanted a piece of meat or butter or sugar or petrol, you had to have ration books and take those. You only had a limited amount. And out of that world of sort of, harshness and deprivation, suddenly when people hit their 16, 17, they invented rock and roll. All those guys who'd been to art school invented rock and roll. There's a sort of renaissance happened, and that they made life bright again. Everything sort of, it seemed to me we were in black and white until about 1962. And then suddenly, the Beatles came along and everything was in color suddenly. And it was really nice. And I think that happens after every war. I think it's a DNA thing. Yep. You said it's odd to give birth in wartime, but it's the opposite. DNA is really encouraging. People don't have, whenever things are dangerous, people shag like crazy. It's true. You ever read about the French Revolution in the prisons the night before, who's being executed? There's the orgy after orgy is going on. And that's DNA going, heavens, we're killing people. We have to replace them.
Right.
That is amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. So you, when you talk about the birth of rock and roll, you're also heading into your career as a comedian around that same time. So you were at uni, you were doing the Footlights, you were sort of thrust into this world yourself.
Yeah, but we're a bit later, you see. Although we're the same age, they've all started, the Beatles starting at 16. They're in Hamburg, playing 10 or 15 hours a day. So they're doing their learning, and their learning curves early. We are still at college when the Beatles came through Cambridge in 1963 and changed everything. Before then, everybody wore tweed jackets with little leather elbow patches. And then suddenly the Beatles came through, and you're going, people saying, who's your favorite Beatle? And then we bought leather jackets and Beatle jackets. And it just, the whole place changed. And they sort of changed England, the Beatles. I mean, it just suddenly became about youth for the first time.
Yeah.
And partly that's because there was nobody ahead of us or them because of the war. They were all in the army or the navy or the air force. They were all, so they hadn't, lots of people were lost. 60 million people lost their lives in that war. And so the playing field was empty, not so much level as empty. And so that was the same for us when we got onto television, and we're later. We're more like 26 when we get our big breaks. but there's nothing before us. We're not trying to follow now, you know, we're not trying to follow Monty Python or anything.
Yeah.
It's completely blank, the canvas.
And did you feel that as young men and young creators, that there was an empty canvas for you to play
with? I think that's only me in hindsight looking back at it, noticing that that's what happened. I mean, when you're doing things, you assume that's the norm. Even when you're a kid and they put you in a boarding school, you say, well, this is what everybody does. You know, you don't know there's any different worlds going on. And one of the points about writing an autobiography is to look back and think, gosh, look at that. Oh, that happened. And, whoa, isn't that weird? But my point was about our generation was that we were all the same sort of age. And so when we became famous in different areas, it was easy to reconnect.
Yeah.
Because we're some mates, you're the same age group.
Well, there's a wonderful chapter about the 70s and about these strange relationships that you found yourself in with, you know, going down to the south of France and jumping on the back of Bowie's boat. And
I was so jealous. Yeah,
and like these kind of stories where the Rolling Stones comes and hides out with you, having stolen a girlfriend from so-and-so. Like,
the stories are just out of control good in this. I mean, in particular, would you mind, as a taster for the podcast listeners, would you consider telling the Elvis story?
Well, Elvis was extraordinary to us because when we were 12 or 13 in this awful boarding school orphanage in Wolverhampton, Elvis saved our lives. And he suddenly, what's his baby? This voice and style and the haircut and the dancing and the outrageousness that people felt and the outrage they felt against him, we were completely identified with. So I bought a guitar because I wanted to play. So many years later, after we'd done Python, I was reading a biography of Elvis, and I'm reading it, and it says, Elvis called everybody Squire from the Nudge Nudge sketch in Monty Python. And I'm going, what the, you know? I honestly couldn't believe that. And then quite recently, about 5 or 6 years ago, I met Linda Thompson, who was, you know, his penultimate girlfriend, and who'd lived with him for about 5 years. And she said at night in Memphis, when they went to bed, about 2 a.m, television had finished, Elvis would sit in bed with her and make her do Monty Python sketches. And then and then she said, not just any old sketches, he'd do, hello, Mrs. Dean, hello, Mrs. Entity. And you go, no, he didn't. No, don't be silly. That's not possible that this Elvis could have sat in bed with Linda Thompson doing these sketches. And but she did. She knew all. The only reason I believed her, she knew all the words. Yeah. And there was no reason for her to know all the words.
Unless she'd performed it.
But this is something like a running theme, because you've got the Beatles coming through your university days, and then later on you're mates with George Harrison. Like, you're mates. Like, not just passing acquaintances. You become mates with one of the greatest members of the greatest bands in the history.
Well, that's because we got on really well. I mean, when he was a big Python fan, and I was, of course, a huge Beatle fan, but when we met, he was an ex-Beatle. You know, he was retired and gone to live in the countryside, and was just a fascinating man and just a lovely man. And, you know, we just hit it off. And I think because I could play guitar, I could always get on with these guys because, you know, at some point in the evening, you'll break out guitars and you play. Mm-hmm. And I think that was true of George. But there was always something very special about him. And he was, you know, he had so much heart. He was the biggest warm-hearted person. And when the tribute for him, after he died at the Albert Hall, I have never seen so many grown men in tears. All of that generation where they're playing George songs and they're all crying. And it was extraordinary. It was heartbreaking and very touching.
And he ends up being the reason why we all get to have Life of Brian and enjoy Life of Brian, because he, at the last moment, bailed you out.
He's the only reason that the film was made is that he mortgaged his house in Henley for $4.5 million and put it all down for the budget for The Life of Brian. Wow. Because he wanted to see the movie.
You're saying in the book that's the most expensive movie ticket.
Yeah, it's still the most expensive movie ticket in history, exactly. Yeah, yeah. No, but it's true. He did. I mean, can you imagine mortgaging your house and give a group of loonies a chance to make a film about religion? I mean, we tried to sell it elsewhere in L.A., in New York, and it was like trying to sell Springtime for Hitler. They just did not want to know, you know. But so he did make that possible. And also our first film, our second film, really, Holy Grail, was funded by Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, Genesis, Jethro Tull, and they'd all put money into it.
How did that happen? Like, did you do like a little sketch in front of them and said, this is going to be much
there
bigger?
There was no Kickstarter, right?
Yeah, there wasn't.
So you just go to the, you just go to
no,
the local...
but it was because we had a record company called, I can't remember what it was called, but the head of it knew all these people, and he went, we were looking for, I think the film was made for £200,000. So the British Film Corporation were paying half of that, and we were looking for 100,000. So there were 10 lots of 10,000 each, and each of these rock groups put in 10,000.
Wow.
And they didn't want it back. It wasn't like, give us it back. They just wanted to have the film made. And they're still getting money from Spamalot.
Oh. Really?
Yes, they really are. Yeah.
That's so cool.
That's it, yeah. When I think of those movies, because I grew up with the movies, like the because it wasn't until later that I got to see mm-hmm. the Flying Circus. And those movies were just played again and again
until
and again.
Until you could recite them.
And, yeah, until everyone... And, I mean, everywhere you go, you probably have people coming up and reciting bits to you.
What's
is that
the
something...
Most, yeah. What, I'm going to interject. What do people quote the most often to you?
I don't know. I try and stop them. No, only because it's not a conversation where people go, it's like, oh, is your wife a go? I know what I mean. You know, what are you supposed to do? Yes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah. Right. You're right. So I say, you know, it's kind of, your response as a human being is really limited at that point. So I would say, hello, I'm Eric. What's your name? And then they go, then they become human and you can talk to them, you know. But otherwise they're like jukeboxes or joke boxes, you know, playing your stuff.
I'm so glad we didn't open by quoting things at you.
Well, I was just on the radio and somebody played the Black Knight sketch.
Yeah.
And you go, why are you playing this? It's entirely visual. He played this 3-minute sketch on the radio going, right, I'll have you. Going, bang. Right, all right, that's it then. And I'm going, this is radio. What if somebody's listening at home and they have no idea what the hell's going on?
Oh, I'm broken now. Yeah. I don't know if I can speak anymore.
With Life of Brian, I mean, it was such a cohesive movie. Like, out of all the movies, it sort of has the most cohesion to it. And it came from a throwaway line of yours. Like, the whole thing came from a throwaway line. And did that throwaway line just get everyone's imagination at the same time? Was that the...
Well, it was a bad joke of mine. I can't keep my mouth shut. I don't know where it comes from. We were at the opening of the Holy Grail in New York, and a journalist said, what's your next film going to be? And I said, Jesus Christ, Lust for Glory, as you do. And then when we got home, Cleese said, I think that's a very funny, that's a nice idea. I mean, nobody's ever done anything about religion. And it's the same having a blank canvas again. If not everybody's done all these gags, you've got this whole area which you can go into and explore in your own way. And that's what we did. And it was interesting because being sort of Oxbridge grads, we all spent like a month and a half reading the Bible, the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Apocrypha, all about the religion and the history of religion and the history of the Judaic history. And very interesting, fascinating stuff. And then we got together to try and decide what we should make it about. And we decided very early on it was not going to be a series of blasphemous cheap jokes because that would pale very quickly. You could do that for 2 minutes, then what? You know, so we found that the subject was not mocking Christ at all. In fact, he's in the film twice. Because how can you mock somebody? He says, you know, turn the other cheek, forgiveness, you know, feed the poor, look after the sick. You can't send that up. It's impenetrable for the comedy. So we then decided, well, it has to be the followers, the people who say, now what he really means is you should wear tight underwear and not have any sex for the first 60 years of your life. So, you know, it's that about religion that's the scariest and people killing you if you don't agree with them. Mm. You know, those are the areas we attacked. And I think that's why the film has some lasting value because it makes some really sensible points about religion.
So with writing for the Flying Circus, you all went off and did skits together. You wrote music and songs and you wrote your own bits and pieces. But when doing something like Life of Brian, you're sitting in the Caribbean, you're all together. How did that writing process work
Well, that was the Caribbean thing was only the last 2 weeks when we pulled it all together. But the difference between Brian is we knew what our subject was going in. Mm-hmm. We didn't in the Holy Grail. If you look at the first draft of the Holy Grail, only 20% is about Arthur and medieval. The rest takes place in Harrods and the toupee department and various other crazy things. And so when we went back, we said, oh, that's what it should be. It should be about the Holy Grail. And when we did The Meaning of Life, we never got an idea. And even till right at the end when I said, oh, it should be The Meaning of Life, I said, oh, that'll do. So but we didn't have a plot and it didn't have characters that go through. So Brian is the best constructed of all those films.
And was it a whole lot of you sitting around in a room and throwing ideas around, or was it, did someone take a lead and then you all jumped in?
No, it's a bit of both. We always wrote in different groups. I mean, John and Graham would write together, and Michael and Terry would write together, and then I would write on my own, and Gillian would do his things on his own. So, you know, there was a bit of, I think we wrote first, and then we started to settle down. It took us a while to find out what direction we'd take. For a while, Brian was a sort of writer. you know, they were like writers for this person. But it was when we found that he should be the boy next door and mistaken for him.
Yeah.
And that's a tragedy. I mean, to be mistaken for a Messiah is a real tragedy. It's for him a tragedy. He gets crucified. Thanks very much, you know. No matter what he says, they're still, no, you're the Messiah. Oh, only a Messiah would deny his divinity. You must be him. Oh. So I think that's what's funny, is that it is a tragedy.
I mean, but the glorious thing is the way in which you fix the film, because it's going towards this tragic end.
Right.
It's a disastrous tragic end where the hero is crucified, and then you guys are all sitting there going, that's a bit of a dull ending, or a bit sad, a bit morbid. What do you do?
Well, we didn't know how to end it. I mean, they're all going for crucifixion. Most of the lead characters are all going to crucify it. And so I said, no, we should finish with a song. And they said, oh, that's a good idea. And then I think they said, well, we could sing it from the crosses. And Gilliam said, oh, they could dance as well, you know. And I said, oh, it should be a ridiculously cheery song. It should be a cheery uppy song, you know, ridiculous, like looking on the bright side. I actually said that. And I said, maybe it should have a whistle, like a Disney song. And they said, oh, that's good. So then I went home and wrote it.
Did you have any idea that day. Any idea the impact that song would have?
Well, no. I mean, you know, you're just trying to fix a scene. I mean, the Holy Grail is a really crap ending. You know, the police come in and stop it. And my daughter always goes, that's a really awful ending, Dad. It's shit. You know, and they're all right. So this was at least, you know, the song gets you out. It doesn't actually end it, but it gives you a sort of ending when you pull away and they're all looking on the bright side. Even though when you're being crucified, there is no bright side to look on. You know, spoiler alert, you've got maybe an hour or two. So it was ironic. The song was an ironic song,
yeah.
You know, but then it started to be used in real life situations. That was the interesting thing about it.
I like how quickly you put it together, and then you say in the book that you went to a hotel room and put mattresses up and...
But that, yeah, I mean, we recorded it in England, in London, and that very nice sort of jazz backing was done by John Altman, and it's lovely, and all the backing voices. And I'd put on a very neutral sort of lounge singer voice, and somebody picked it up and put it on the web the other day on my Twitter feed. It's really good. They find everything, these guys. And it is, it's boring. You listen to it, that would never have been a hit. It's just really dull. But when I was... played it to the crew, they liked the song, and I'm going, no, the voice is wrong. It should be sung by Mr. Cheeky, who's a character in the film. You know, one of those guys, no, crucifixion for me, yeah, really, yeah, pulling your leg, you know, nah. And he was, so we went into a hotel bedroom in Tunisia with a sound recordist, and I had a bottle of Booker, and then I just did the whole thing live in one take. You know, something's in love, bang, they can really make you mad. And the whole song comes to life because of that. And that recording you hear is actually from a hotel room in Tunisia.
Amazing.
and then that's the same recording that years later, as you discover, that this song is the, you know, the most played at funerals.
And then, that's the same vocal.
Same vocal.
From a bedroom in Tunisia.
And then it becomes a hit in 91, was it?
In 91 it became a hit because the soccer songs, football fans, began to sing it on terraces when they were losing. You know, and then so then this guy Simon Mayo began to play it on the radio every day at the start of his show, and then Virgin re-released it, and it just shot up the charts. It was extraordinary.
That must have been.
It was
amazing.
Really weird. So that was extraordinary, and then I actually got to sing it for the Queen on the Royal Variety Show, and then in about 2004. Somebody says it suddenly went to number one as the most requested songs at British funerals. Wow. I mean, who even knew there was a top 10? Hey, come on, man. Number 10 tonight, bubbling under on funeral songs is. And then it replaced My Way. And it's been there since 2004 as the most requested song at British funerals.
And you got to do it at the Olympics.
And I got what?
You got to do it at the Olympics too, as well.
I got, yes, absolutely. I love doing it at the Olympics. But I find it's kind of, it's nice that it's a cheery, uppy, dying song. I think that's quite good.
Well, we're now looking, facing a world without Eric Idle to tap to. And so it's looking rather glum for us in the future as you leave this room and you leave us alone by ourselves. Is there any chance that we could maybe just, I don't know, sing our way out of this little podcast?
No chance at all. Play it on. You just sort of save royalties, aren't you? Just drop the needle on the gramophone. Come on. Give it. You know how much royalties you get for a funeral? Nothing. Nothing. Zero royalties. Number one for 15 years. Not a penny in royalties. It's all burning up in front of you.
What about just the whistle?
You can whistle.
Well, I can't now because I'm...
It's hard to whistle when you're laughing, isn't it? It's very hard.
I'm going to try.
Go for it. You've whistled with Eric in the room. Eric, thank you so much for coming and talking to us. It's been an absolute pleasure. This is our favourite podcast by a mile.
Oh,
yeah.
Thank you very much. Nice talking to you. Yeah, I'm shaking hands, by the way. I love that. It's a podcast. We can't see that. He leans forward and shakes hands.
And you can get hold of Eric's book at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.